4WZA, K82VNG. Great court.
Oh, very good, old man. You're full quieting into the machine for sure. I'm running 15 watts. Name here is Michael. The call again is Kilowatt India number 4, Whiskey Charlie America. A lot of people think that the Charlie is a Zed, but it's not. It's just the way I talk. Back to you.
FCA, okay. Yeah, no, you got a good signal, and 15 watts is probably not much more than you need. You may actually be closer to the repeater than I am. It's on Paris Mountain somewhere, and Asheville, too, I think, is at a higher elevation.
I'm up pretty high, and the machine is very strong here with my antenna on the roof. It's funny, I really can't get into it with a handheld unless I hike up someplace high or get up on the roof with a handheld. What a difference just 30 or 40 feet in the air makes from here. I get a little bit of knife edge into Paris Mountain from the rooftop antenna, so it does a good job. I can get into this machine no problem with a half a watt with a handheld, but the antenna and feed line are pretty efficient. It's just a common GP3 up on the roof, and it's fed with LMR400, which is really the secret weapon for sure. The rig here is an ICOM 2730A, which I really love because it's got such a big, huge display, and it's got full-time dual-band receive, which is cool.
Okay, now I'm losing you, but all right, yeah, I got most of that. ICOM, I don't know, I'm kind of mixed on ICOM. ICOM's ergonomics always seemed funny to me. It's like, okay, I can't get the hang of how do I leave this mode and go into this other mode, or how do I program a frequency in here. You know, then again, none of the other makers really make it that much easier. I suppose it depends on what you're used to.
ICOM equipment for a long time, and I find this radio very easy to program. It always makes me laugh when people talk about how horrible it is to operate. But everybody that says that, it seems, is coming from using Yaesu's. I guess Yaesu's is very different than the way this radio operates. To me, it's very simple. I know exactly what to do, but it's because I've only ever used ICOM, so there you go.
It's the reverse Polish radio. It's the HP calculator of radios. If you remember the old Hewlett-Packard calculators from maybe the 70s. Yeah, I guess, let's see, my other, the other HF set I got is Yaesu. This one's a Kenwood. Well, you know, as I said, it's a question of what you're used to.
It's ICOM. Although I will say, I'm not happy in the direction they're going with their HF gear and stuff. I dislike their new SDR stuff tremendously. I'm really, really glad I have an ICOM 7410. Which is a giant heavy rig that you can transmit on all day long at full power. It barely gets warm. And the other nice thing about it is it's got big honking actual controls, no touchscreen nonsense. It also has better receiver performance. It's much, much better in terms of dealing with strong out-of-band signals. It's actually really important where I live here in Asheville because I've got multiple AM stations not far from the house, and I got a couple of volts on the antenna on, you know, medium wave. So that can really play havoc with some of this direct conversion stuff. Over.
It's nice to have actual controls instead of menus. Although you see, in a sense, that's kind of, a lot of the older Kenwood equipment went too far the other way. So let's see, there's buttons within buttons. There's buttons that turn on other buttons. If you look at some of the older Kenwood stuff, it's, you know, big jar of buttons. They do have good audio, mostly.
Fantastic. I've gotten nothing but great reports with the ICOM as well, but I'm using an external microphone with it. I'm using the SM30, which is a great microphone for it. Got an SM50 as well. Don't use it very often, but it works nice. What's interesting about the ICOM, there are menus, to be sure, But it's stuff that you don't change all the time. Like, you can go in and adjust the treble and bass response for receive, and that's pretty much a one-time set and forget, and the same for transmit. All the stuff that you need to do on the fly is very quick and easy to get to, and it's fast. So it's a joy to operate, and a very capable receiver. Nicest thing about it to me, aside from the fact that its receiver performance is off the chart for sensitivity and being able to handle strong stuff, is it's got really killer DSP noise reduction. Where I live is very noisy electrically, and it's the difference between being able to operate HF at all and just having to pack it in totally. Over.
John Butch, HF works years since, I guess my antenna wire blew down and I never bothered to put it back up. That's all it is, really, just run another antenna.
My work as well. Also, I moved the shack upstairs, which means I got to run a new feed line. I got to drill a hole in the wall and put a bushing in, all that stuff. Bury the feed line, run it, install an antenna tuner at the base of the tree since I don't want to tune through the feed line anymore, and go from there. So it's actually a pretty big project, but I've got so much furlough time coming up, I should be able to get it done by the end of July. Over.
A lot of laid-off workers right now from various, you know, a lot of us with nothing but time on our hands, and still nothing ever gets done.
You know, most of my customers are closed, so there's not a lot to do anyway. I think Friday I did one call, and that was it. And the rest of the time I was doing training, which is boring as dirt, but, you know, I didn't even have to change my clothes sitting there in the sweatpants all day. That's what work looks like now. It's pretty lame.
83.
Work expands to fill the time allowed to it. If the six-month project is now due in 12 months, then somehow it'll still take 12 months. What sort of work are you currently doing?
A couple of reasons. I'll be leaving the job probably at the end of this year, and I can talk about what I did, but can't talk about it right now. Sorry.
E7LT.
Don't worry. I'll make sure the black helicopters don't hear about it.
Committing. Everyone hears about it.
True. And it's funny how I hear people talk on the radio like they're on, you know, their personal phone line. You'll hear all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah, and you can look my call up and everything. I mean, there's no security, so you know how it goes.
News since about 2007 or so, when did that one article come out? We know there's no security now anyway. All our, you know, even our private radio and telephone traffic and internet traffic is supposedly being intercepted.
As it goes back way further, my father had a friend who was a VP at Northern Telecom, and they would, they made switches, you know, giant switchgear for the telephone company, and as part of the one of the requirements to import their switches into the United States was each switch had to have a full bandwidth port so they could sniff all the traffic on the switch, all of it simultaneously, full bandwidth port required to install it in the big telco switching areas in the U.S. So, yeah, since the 80s for sure. Over.
It's okay. A lot of that might have still been analog in the 80s. Yeah, even easier now. There was something that goes back to the late 90s, mid-90s. I think it was during the Clinton administration. They always give these names, things Orwellian names, like the Communications Security Act. The Communications Security Act basically said that there had to be a backdoor into mobile switching centers and central offices. So you could just basically go in and tap any line, not even really a tap, just sniff the traffic.
CA returning. Yeah, they've been doing that forever. You know, during the Cold War, they monitored, you know, for sure, all, you know, transatlantic calls. But the reality is they've been monitoring domestic stuff for a very, very long time. And just listening to everything, and I think they used keywords would trigger stuff, you know. So there you go. It was a lot cruder back then. Now it's much more powerful. They use AI to snoop on it all, and they'll just automatically open up a dossier on you and the whole bit, and if it gets to a certain point, they'll actually look at you, but they record everything now.
Back to the keyword recognition thing goes back to a system known as Echelon, which might go back to the 1970s, and it initially was looking at international traffic, but I'm sure Big Ear has been turned inward. And, you know, people are always, oh, I got nothing to worry about. I mean, but do they really have time to, they don't have time to monitor little old me. Yeah, the thing you got to remember is it's not a person doing this. It's a tireless automaton that really can monitor a million things at once.
I don't realize, you know, the same thing is true of, like, HF traffic. You know, I love high-end HF receivers. And they don't make really, really killer ones anymore because the really cool stuff that used to be built by Watkins Johnson and CEI and the others that was used for intercepting traffic, you know, they had cubicles and they had these guys sitting there listening and stuff, listening centers all over the place. That's not done anymore because they have just a whole bunch of receivers in racks. And they just record all of the bandwidth. So if something happens, they can go back and tune the spectrum in real time from the memory of the computer. So it's not monitored by human beings anymore. It's done by AI, and they just record all of it. I kid you not, they record it all. So for that reason, you're not going to see any surplus really killer radios designed for a human interface because they're not used anymore. Over.
What I started to say is, yeah, people don't realize, you know, something that works like the human brain, but amplified a million times. I always said the one law that's not, that eventually is going to impede on our freedom is not the Patriot Act or anything like that. The law that will eventually kill us is Moore's Law. Because, yes, you really can monitor everything, or actually capture everything in real time. When the NSA says they monitor something, it means they're basically going back over something they've already collected. And it just now became of interest. You know, it could have been from months ago.
And as you know, memory just keeps getting cheaper and cheaper. You know, Moore's Law is a thing. Although we're now running into sort of the limitations inherent in how small we can make transistors, and how small the lines, you know, the fabs can run. It's really getting tiny now, so it'll be interesting to see how much quantum computing impacts that. That should be entertaining. KI4WCA.
TNG, yeah, I was having that discussion also earlier somewhere. I think we might have hit the peak of Moore's Law maybe a decade ago. You know, you have the complexity versus power versus complexity curve. Computing power increases arithmetically, complexity increases geometrically. We're already kind of at the, I don't know that there's an absolute limit, but, you know, certainly there's an asymptote. We're at the point now, we're at the flat part of that curve, where things can get not that much more complex and really not that much more powerful. I built a machine 10 years ago, let's see, back then it was 32 nanometers, or 45 nanometers. Now I think a lot of fabrication is down to 14 nanometers, but I don't know if it's going to get that much smaller, which is why that 10-year-old machine still works well for me.
Nanometer stuff in orbit, because as you start getting really small, it makes it easier for a single cosmic ray to wipe out a really critical part of the circuit. I want to say they're looking at 7.5 or 8 nanometer fabs right now, but I don't think it can go a lot smaller than that. The advantage, of course, to going smaller is that you can make mobile devices that are much more powerful. because obviously when you're running at that scale, the voltage and the current required is not very large. It's just much more efficient when you get really, really tiny. At the same time, you know, any radioactivity or something like that, that kind of circuitry is a lot more vulnerable. So there you go. I would say also that I think the biggest growth we're going to see now is just massively parallel construction. And the biggest issue with that, of course, is writing the language to operate it, kind of like a Beowulf cluster sitting on your desktop. That'll be cool. I can't wait to get a PC I can actually do galactic modeling on. That'll be epic. Back to you.
You go from 32 nanometers down to 14 nanometers. Okay, you've increased density by a factor of 4, because that's half in both directions, right? If it's half as wide, it's 4 times as dense. But now you got to remember you got another problem. You've got things like quantum tunneling. Electrons going across barriers that should be insulators. Okay, how do you eliminate that, or reduce that? Well, you reduce power, reduce the voltage, you know, reduce signal levels. Of course, now you got another problem. You got the problem where the signal now is barely above the noise. So, yeah, I tend to agree. With current fabrication techniques, I don't know how much further we're going to go.
I see it getting much smaller. I really don't. However, I do see it getting massively parallel. You know, instead of, like, talking about 32-bit systems, we'll be talking about stuff that's much, much bigger, 256 or more, 512 wide. That would be totally cool.
You're saying parallel as far as more processor cores and, well, let's see, increasing the word size to that sort of width, what does that really get you? I can do computations on larger numbers, possibly on an array of numbers all at the same time. 64-bit bits versus 32-bits, I'm not even sure what's that really got. Is 64-bit software and operating system that much more efficient? I got to look into that.
I mean, the advantage when you start using gigantic words, you have to have memory that's that wide as well, is that you can go in and out of memory with an enormous amount of information very, very fast. It would be ideal for stuff like video editing, things like that, I would guess. But yeah, I was also talking about lots and lots of cores in parallel, but you know, you can have very wide words and just break the words up and have them processed by separate cores and then reassemble, which makes the design of the buffer entertaining, to say the least.
Yeah. There was a, what are they called? I think bit slice processors. You know, small processors like 4 bits, 8 bits, like an assemble and make a processing element as wide as needed to be. As for going massively parallel, there's problems there as well as far as you get to the point where communication between all the processor elements, you know, cache coherency problems, concurrency problems, that sort of thing, that starts to eat up a lot of real estate on the chip. There was one company, I think about 25, maybe almost 30 years ago, I think they were called... Oh, I forget the name of the company. They were making something called the Connection Machine, which was something like 4,096 processors, all in parallel. But they started to run up against the, synchronization limits.
For problems with noise when you're building designs like that, too. You have to have fairly exotic construction techniques. Otherwise, all that stuff going on at once in a small space is a real problem.
At some point, you take the, all 1,300 cores and put them in liquid nitrogen. That reduces your quantum noise, your thermal noise, right? And let's see, what else? Of course, now, the heat that those cores are going to generate, I don't know how... Yeah, cooling is still going to be a problem.
Your at-home system, for sure. But I do hope to see, you know, desktops with even more cores. I want to say that Intel's latest Monster, and I could be wrong, but I want to say it's a 10-core chip. Is that correct?
Someone who's running a 16-core chip. Or maybe it's an 8-core chip with Intel's weird hyper-threading thing that they do. And so it appears to be 16 cores.
They just introduced something that's got 10 cores, which I just looked at that and was like, what the heck are you doing? That's cool, but 16 would be better for sure. Yeah, you're right about the hyper-threading magic and all that. I'll be honest, I really like my current system. It's very nice. I don't know if it's 8 cores or 6, I'm not sure. But it runs real well. It's a, when I bought it, it was close to the top of the ranking. Now it's lower mid. You know, it doesn't take very many years for the processor's performance to plummet, you know, in the big curve of things. But what's nice is the die I'm using is only 65 watts, and a lot of the hot rod stuff is 100 watts and up, which, of course, runs the electric bill up and heats up the room in the summer. And I don't like that very much at all. KI4WCA.
KA, KD2B, and G. I don't even know what Intel really... Based on what I've read on that hyper-threading deal that they got, I think this is what they're doing. You've got two pipelines, two instruction pipelines, basically feeding like 1.5 processors. It's a single execution unit, or I guess what I used to call an ALU, arithmetic logic unit, the thing that actually executes the instructions. But you've got two complete sets of registers, two program counters, two status registers, two sets of general purpose registers, stack pointers, segment pointers. They're all duplicated. So basically it's a zero time context switch. So you can run two threads twice as slowly.
Yeah. Computing has changed a whole lot since the early days of IBM, to be sure. My father was a design engineer for IBM, and he started doing maintenance work and working on the Sage computers, you know, the NORAD computers that were made out of tubes that were housed in gigantic 10-story buildings that were atom bomb-proof. And I still have an award that he won for his design work on the buffer for the IBM 360, for example. And he worked up until the 80s, and then he retired. He took a golden parachute, and he was like one of the last people that could do that. After that, the guys just got fired, which was sad. But he did real well at the corporation. He worked there, you know, starting in, I want to say 59 or 60, and worked up through the 80s. So he did real well, or maybe early 90s, actually. Early 90s is when he left. So that's pretty cool. And I've been lucky to meet a lot of guys that worked on the early stuff. And so as a result, I know more about the history of computers than most people do. Over.
Sage. Okay. An early NORAD defense computer system. And actually, one of the first uses of computer networking, system of networked machines talking to each other, almost in a sense the predecessor of ARPANET, DARPANET, and I guess plain regular internet. Or maybe I'm thinking of some other system. Was that Sage?
ARPANET for sure. Give you an idea, I remember taking a walk with my father around the block and him telling me about the development of something called SSL. Isn't that a hoot?
Secure Sockets Layer, how long has that been around? Or are we thinking of something else?
No, Secure Socket Layer. That's absolutely right. I remember talking to my father about it because they were discussing, you know, it just being invented. So, you know, it's funny, the people that use the internet and stuff take all this stuff for granted, but I remember when it was developed, which is cool.
There's email, news groups, and a couple FTP sites. The garbage heap that started out as the World Wide Web wasn't out there yet. And, oh, by the way, who remembers what the term spam originally referred to?
I don't know where the word spam came from, but I do know that when I started out, I was using like a dial-up and going to a local Unix server and surfing the web through that. And everything was command line. I didn't have graphics or anything. I surfed the web in text-only mode.
Maybe, so that's, you know, early, maybe early 1990s. No, spam is used to refer, is now used to refer to unsolicited, you know, rubbish email, random people trying to sell you random things. But the term spam originally referred to newsgroups. I don't know if you've seen newsgroups. I guess you have the equivalent, they were the original chat forums where people would post messages on a variety of topics, you know, everything literally soup to nuts. And the term spam was to cross-post the same message across all these topics, you know, without regard to what the topic was. You know, it was, I guess then as now, somebody trying to sell you something.
I remember people getting in trouble with on that, on the Usenet that I used to belong to 8 billion years ago. And what was really funny, there was a picnic once I went to, and it was where we got to meet in real life all the local users that were using the locally hosted Unix server. And, of course, you know, we all knew the guy that ran the server anyway. But we had a cookout, and we all got to hang out together, which was actually really cool.
That's who I'm trying to think of. Yeah, the original Yahoo forums or whatever you got now. But yeah, I remember when the internet was that. It was Usenet postings and email and pretty much it. You know, and the occasional FTP site where, you know, you might have various files. Back then measured probably in kilobytes or tens of kilobytes that people would swap around. The World Wide Web, as we understand it now, may have just been coming into existence. We're going back, I think, early 1990s.
I want to say the first machine I used to surf on was a 386 SX33, and then I upgraded to a 486 machine. Then my father gave me his old discarded Pentium, as in just Pentium. And that was cool, and that's the first machine I used to surf images. And now, of course, you know, I'm using a Monster, and I can stream 4K video and all that stuff. I remember I was very angry at the Usenet guy when he said, oh, yeah, you've got to upgrade because we're going to be using this and that and the other thing. And I got really disgusted and pissed off, and I quit the Usenet. And I went out and I bought, I can't remember what I bought, but it was big enough that I could use a different service. And then I just started going nuts. So, yeah, I've been surfing the web since the days of dial-up. But every time I've advanced, it's been glorious. At this point, you know, I'm using Charter Cable. I've got a Monster router. And, yeah, it's very different than when I started. And that's an understatement. In the old days, I really liked going to, like, various university servers and doing research on UFOs and the Men in Black. Oh, my God, that was so much fun. I wish I could find the stuff that I found back then. It was really, really cool in the ancient days.
All restricted to dial-up bandwidth. I remember being restricted to that until the early 2000s. Let's see, at one point briefly I had an ISDN line running into the house. Wow, that's three times as fast as analog dial-up. You're really moving. And then DSL first started to come. Was it cable first or DSL? But, see, the thing there is, is the bandwidth driving the content, or is the content driving the bandwidth? In other words, as the World Wide Web starts to get larger, you know, more and more basically junk out there, to the point where to go to a web page, I'm downloading 100 megabytes of junk. Is that driving the bandwidth, or is the bandwidth driving the content? Because it's like nobody knows how to make a small web page anymore.
Kidding. I mean, it's disgusting. That's why I run Script Killer. I don't even execute scripts. If I click on a page and it comes up blank, I'm just like, up yours, and I leave, you know. Unless it's something I'm really interested in, then I'll allow just the page to run. But I'll open up pages, and there'll be a list that runs all the way down the right-hand side of the screen, showing all the scripts that are blocked. I'm just like, I'm leaving now.
I mean, is it that content that's doing it, or is it like affiliate links? See, if it was my web design company, here would be my rule. I'm going to have a bunch of terminals set up that represent the, that are deliberately degraded to represent the slowest service people usually have. Don't bring me a web page that takes more than 4 or 5 seconds to load on the slowest possible connection. Don't give me 1,200 pages of client-side scripting, and especially I don't want to see Flash, Shockwave, streaming video, none of this. And especially I hate it when video pops up without you asking it to, and all of a sudden there's some music blaring out of your speakers. Please don't do that or you're fired.
WCA returning. Yeah, absolutely. I loathe all of those things, which is why I'm running Script Killer all the time, as well as Ghostery and AdBlock Plus. Ha ha! No, I can watch YouTube and it's actually somewhat enjoyable, I guess. But, no, two things drive bandwidth. One is that people want to play with video and they want to look at images. Images are a big deal, and that requires bandwidth. So, you've got to have a bigger pipeline to deliver that, so that drives it. And the other thing is that people want to try to do more things at the same time, so yeah, it's kind of a drag. I don't like the fact that everybody needs basically a fairly monstrous system and a really, really wide connection. For example, you know, in Japan, everybody's got fiber. We don't in this country. And it amazes me when I click on these websites and I see a list of stuff that's trying to execute at the same time. It's disgusting. All these people trying to make money off of ad revenue, you know, those parasites really make the internet a whole lot less fun to use.
The question was simply phrased as a chicken or egg problem. You know, which came first? The content providers saw, oh, look, a bigger pipe, so we can shove more crap down the pipe. Or did they decide to push more first, and then that necessitated building more bandwidth? You know, did the bigger pipe come first, or did the bigger load of crap come first?
First, I really do, and they built up to deal with the demand because people wanted images. That was the thing. Even if it was just looking at a picture or a short video of a tornado or something in the Midwest, stuff like that, it was because people wanted to download big stuff that they started making the infrastructure bigger because they got saturated. And this is sad, but it's true. The demand for pornography drove the building out of bandwidth probably more than anything else.
It's a multi-billion dollar a year business. I don't know how big a business. It's a lot of money in porn. But yeah, people wanted... Okay, pictures aren't that big. Video is horrendous. Oh, and they wanted streaming, and that's where it gets worse. They wanted to use their internet connection as a substitute for a television station. So that means we got to have streaming. We got to have enough bandwidth to stream video. You got to remember, too, though, a lot of the cable companies are... They started actually building this out maybe in the mid to late 90s. There was dark copper and dark fiber in the ground right around before the time that this was even. So the cable companies are saying, oh, we had to spend billions and billions to upgrade our infrastructure. No, you don't. You pretty much already had it in the form of dark fiber and dark copper.
but they didn't have the switching equipment installed yet.
Not, but they had the physical wiring. You know, if I got to run, let's say, a 2 or 3 inch conduit to put, let's say 30 pairs of wiring through, it's just as easy to put another 50 pairs of wiring through the same conduit, or fiber, or whatever it is you're laying in the ground. So that's, you're already prepared for future capacity, and then adding more switching equipment at the other end of the, at either end of the connection, you know, that's not the most difficult part. You've already done the hard part. You put the cable in the ground.
That's actually what they did for sure. And the other thing, too, was when they said that they could give you more bandwidth, of course, they charged you a whole lot more money for wider. I remember when having a T1 connection was like, oh, you're the man.
Forth on Charter with that, too. I threatened to quit them a bunch of times. Sometimes it's actually worked, but now it's like, well, we don't really need more customers. Yeah, I said, you know, in the past couple of years, my internet bill's gone from $30 to, let's say, $45, $50, $55, $60, and now $70. Oh, but you have 200 megabits per second now. Yeah, and that helps me exactly how. Can I go back to having, like, 40 or 60 megabits? Because that was fine. If it's half the price, I'll do that. But, you know, no, sorry.
Up front, I was having a problem. I was having issues, and so apparently I was being throttled at a certain level. And so the guy came out, he replaced the drop, he replaced the wiring in the house, everything. I'm like, it looks like I'm being throttled. He's like, I agree. So I called up the billing retards, and I'm like, look, I'm paying this much money, and I'm only getting this much bandwidth. What's the deal? And they're like, well, you're on a legacy plan, and you only get, like, you know, X amount. I'm like, well, how much more does it cost to upgrade to the basic service, which now guarantees this much higher level? They're like, well, it's more money. I'm like, how much? And the reply was, $1. I'm like, well, upgrade it right now, you... I can't say that term on the air, but I cursed at them. And shortly after, you know, I had no trouble streaming Netflix after that.
No. You can, let's see, we'll do the Battlestar Galactica thing. You frackin' frackers, don't frack with me again. Yeah, I know what you probably said to them.
Severely, and they were extremely sorry and all that stuff, and immediately turned it on, and yeah, my bill went up $1 a month. And the thing was, they were really evil about, they didn't tell legacy customers that their base service was now greatly in excess in terms of bandwidth compared to you know, what those legacy customers had had before, and the difference was only $1 a month. So it was, you know, frankly, it was criminal. I think I was limited before to 1 megabyte a second. And now, of course, it's a whole lot faster than that.
Service started at either 30 or 60, and then 100, and then 200. Oh, but where you're paying more because you're getting double the bandwidth. I'm like, okay. I'm not going to be in the position of an engineer trying to explain it to a salesman, but you actually didn't really have to do anything to give me the capacity. The capacity was already there, but I wasn't going to try to explain it to him.
Hear ya. You know, shortly after I got the massive pipe into the house, I put in a monster router because the daughters, the wife, they're all running around the house with tablets glued to their faces, streaming video, you know, and before, it made my surfing the web experience extremely lame, but now, it's no problem, and it's fabulous, but I think $70 a month is a little bit on the high side for that. I really do.
But it is here, unfortunately. It started out at, let's say, well, $29.95. Let's say it started out at $30. That was just a 1 or 2 year promotional rate. So it went to $45, $50, $55. At one time I got mad, and actually, sometimes this works, but sometimes they just don't really care. I threatened to quit them. I can take my business elsewhere, you know. Well, I can't really, but... Oh, well, we can give you the promotional rate for another year. Oh, great, in another year I got to fight with you again. But now Charter was bought out by Time Warner, or the other way around. So not only is the level of caring gone down, the level of service probably has as well.
UCA. Yeah, it's ridiculous. It makes me very sad how much they charge for broadband connection. Oh, well, it is what it is, and I'll just have to cope. I will say that having such a big pipe in the house has been absolutely wonderful during the after time, as it were, when everybody's on furlough, because there's a whole lot of bored kids in the house sitting there grooving on the digital content.
He did. Read a book or a magazine. I went to the thrift store and they had a bunch of those 500-piece or 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzles. For some reason, in recent months, those are flying off the shelves. Yeah, we didn't have no internet. We entertained ourselves.
The books are my childhood to prove it. Well, look, I've got a sign right now. I've got a cooked dinner, so 73, and I enjoyed it very, very much. Thank you for answering my call.
I was going to go shopping. I'm sitting here in the car park burning gas. I guess I'll go home.
So, why can't you go shopping?
I'll do that. I've just been sitting out here for the past 20 minutes on this QSO. Yeah, no problem. I've been hoarding up so much, I don't really know if I need anything. I just had to get out of the house.
For excuses to leave myself, it's just the way it is. I hate it. I've got plenty of toilet paper and all the other stuff, so I'm good. I've been stocking up since January. I could see this coming like the light at the end of the tunnel. I knew it was a train.
Toilet paper, beef jerky, shotgun shells. Ain't nobody gonna steal my beef jerky and toilet paper. Yeah, people did go a bit off the wall there for a while, coming into every store in town and seeing no paper anywhere. All right, let me get out of here. I already forgot your call sign. It'll come to me a minute later. But KD2BNG, you 73s, you have a good one.
73 to you, old man, from KI4WCA. Hope to work you again soon. Bye-bye.
KI4WCA, okay. West Charlie, I can't even put it. All right, I'll remember that. Talk to you later.